On Wednesday, January 28th, the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation held its annual Economic Forecast Luncheon at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center. Todd Buchholz, a former White House Director of Economic Policy, gave the keynote address. It was entitled, Our Economy in the Age of Change. Given the importance of the topic and the speaker's expertise, KSKA is presenting Mr. Buchholz's Anchorage Address in its entirety. We hope you find this program informative and entertaining.
I have to warn you, whenever you hear a financial expert introduced or an economist and you hear about credentials and degrees and the like, you have to take it with more than a grain of salt. You need the whole Morton's container of salt. There's a story about Albert Einstein in heaven. He's there at the pearly gates. A man comes up fresh from Earth. Einstein asks the fellow, what was your IQ? Guy says, my IQ was 150. Einstein says, wunderbar, 150. We'll talk about physics and fusion. Next person comes up, this time a woman. Einstein asks, madam, your IQ? She says, 140. He said, that's fabulous. We'll talk about the World Trade Organization, the price of energy. Next guy comes up, looks a little sheepish. Einstein looks him up and down, pops the question. Guy kicks the dirt, fesses up, my IQ? Just 85. Einstein says, really, 85? You think the NASDAQ will be going up this year? Let's face it, over the last 20 years, those people who occupied the corner offices at Merrill Lynch, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, and all the others had no better idea what was going to happen to our stock portfolios, our bond portfolios, the price of oil, than the Beardstown ladies, right? Cookie-baking grandmas from their investment club did better than the chief investment officer of Merrill Lynch. How is this possible? Did smart people become dumb? Did advanced degrees count for nothing? Well, what happened was the building blocks of the world economy just shifted around before our eyes, creating a new era of competition for all of us. Now, I'm so pleased to be here in Anchorage today, especially to follow Bill with his very expert forecast and explanation of how the Anchorage economy is weathering the storm, the global storm that's sweeping across every place. What I'd like to do this afternoon is talk about, at first, these big building blocks, these sweeping changes, and then we can get down to the question of, all right, what exactly is going on with the U.S. economy at the moment? And what is going on in Washington, D.C., and how can that make things better or how it can make things worse? I have to tell you, when Bill was going through his discussion and he mentioned Anchorage was going to benefit by having a new correctional facility, a new psychiatric hospital, I thought this would be perfect for Washington, D.C. So, I just love to send that information back east. Look, we live in incredibly tumultuous times. I've got a couple images for you here. I live most of my life on the East Coast, so I'm not unfamiliar with snowstorms and shoveling snow. But I now happen to live in California. There is my governor. There's Arnold Schwarzenegger, my governor. He's filling up his GM Hummer. Now, because he's married to a Kennedy, it's a hybrid Hummer now. But he's got his Hummer there. And next to that other image, Hot Wheels cars, Mattel Toys Hot Wheels cars. I actually brought with me a Hot Wheels car. I loved Hot Wheels when I was a kid. Do you realize today, this tumultuous economy we're living in, today, the market capitalization, the value of Hot Wheels is greater than the value of all the shares of General Motors? It's not to scale 100 to 1. I am saying Mattel Hot Wheels could buy GM. They've obviously decided not to. All right? I mean, these are incredible times. GM's not a sponsor, are they, Dennis? AT&T's a sponsor, and I'm very proud to tell you I got my iPhone here, and I was able to speak to my daughter in the UK. Wells Fargo, where's Wells Fargo? Yeah, that mortgage thing, we'll be there. We'll get there. All right, no, you got my mortgage, all right. We live in an era of hyper-competition, speed, scissors, and peoples. The speed of change is incredible. The very moment that Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve Board, turns on his microphone, I hold on to my wallet, right? Because I know within a second, his slightest statement can rob me of what I've got. Maybe it can make me some money. The Fed had a meeting today. It came out and announced that it's keeping interest rates at 0%. The Dow today actually closed up 200 points. which is nice to get a little good news once in a while. But the speed of change is incredible in this economy. We live in an era of shockwaves of change. Now, you're going to look up here at this slide and say, wait a minute, I thought he's going to talk about economics. This looks like his travelogue, right? There's the Berlin Wall. These look like political, social photos. This is economics. This is understanding the sweeping changes across the world. The Berlin Wall. Sweeping changes that affect us. I'm not giving you a tour to tell you what's going on 8,000 miles from here. I'm telling you it affects us here today. The Berlin Wall, 1989. The Berlin Wall comes crashing down. The March of Freedom. President Reagan had demanded, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. The wall came down. I was serving in the White House in 1989. I could talk to you about the politics of Poland and the Czech Republic, but AEDC and Heather didn't invite me to come here to talk about the politics of Poland. I'm supposed to talk about the economy in the U.S. There's economics in that photograph of the Berlin Wall. For every square foot of Berlin Wall cement that crumbled to the ground as dust, hundreds and hundreds of workers who'd been trapped behind that wall, trapped under communism, are suddenly free. Free to do what? Free to vote, free to travel, free to speak their mind, but also free to compete. Who do they compete against? Against you, against me, against somebody writing software at the University of Alaska, or somebody assembling textiles in North Carolina? One reason why the economic models of the Federal Reserve Board and all the major research institutions in the world haven't done much good in 20 years is when you introduce hundreds of millions of workers into the worldwide workforce, and if you add the opening of India and China, that's billions, it pushes down labor rates for middle-class people around the world. All right, look at those chopsticks. Middle-class America, middle-class Europe, middle-class Japan feel as if they're in a pincer movement right now, and have been actually for the last few years. Think about when then-Senator Barack Obama and Senator Hillary Clinton were campaigning in Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania. They looked at middle-class voters and they saw the two prongs of this pincer movement. Number one, they can't get higher wages. Why not? Because they're now competing against a billion new workers from around the world. Secondly, when they went to the supermarket to buy dinner, to buy food, to put in the shopping cart for dinner, they paid more for everything in the shopping cart. Why? Because those billion new workers around the world pushed up commodity prices because they expected, as we do, three meals a day. Actually, I expect six or seven meals a day, but I can get by on three. The entire world, right? This pincer movement. And then, of course, we've had the incredible corporate combinations taking place. I live in San Diego, and SeaWorld is a big tourist destination in San Diego. And people in my town are really worried and upset because Anheuser-Busch has now become a Belgian beer company. And they own SeaWorld. And we don't know who gets custody of Shamu in this whole marriage thing going on. Right, so the corporate combinations shake confidence, right? Well, you just had the news, you know, Bank of America bailing out and buying Merrill Lynch, and then you discover that Merrill Lynch, is Merrill Lynch a sponsor? I need to be careful here. All right. Look, the CEO of Merrill Lynch, I'm going to digress for a moment. The CEO of Merrill Lynch, this came out this week, spent $1.2 million decorating his office. Literally, $20,000 on a chair, all right? Hold that thought for a couple minutes because I'm going to bring up a different kind of banking CEO in a couple of minutes. The entire world map is being rewritten before our eyes. I have a daughter in high school who last year was studying for the AP World History exam, and this was a map from one of her textbooks. Silk routes, Marco Polo, 700 years ago, trade between Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. What were they trading 700, 600 years ago? They were trading dates, figs, prunes, you know, breakfast for old people. That's what they were trading. Those silk routes are back, but they're not trading ceramics and dates. They're trading petrochemicals. They're trading petrochemicals and financial flows. You saw back in 1999, Sinopec, Chinese petrochemical company, was rated 50th in the world. By 2005, they're number 7. This world map is being rewritten. I mentioned my daughter in the AP World History exam. I don't know if you've got kids in high school. these grueling exams. My daughter was locked in her room for, I don't know, a week with a stack of books this high, and I hadn't seen her for several days. I got a little worried, so I knocked on the door, and I heard from behind the door her faint voice saying, "You can't help me." I thought I could give her a cookie or something. She says, AP World History. She says, "I have to learn everything that's ever happened by the day after tomorrow." You know, it would be easier for us today to learn everything that's ever happened before than to figure out what that world map is going to look like 5 or 10 years from now. How did we get into the economic crunch that's crippling many parts of the U.S.? I mean, thank God Anchorage and Alaskan banks and homeowners were not as greedy and aggressive, right, and irresponsible as much of the rest of the country. Here's how it happened. I sum it up this way: lack of skin in the game. Mr. and Mrs., I deserve 4 bedrooms and a jacuzzi, even though I never saved a dime in my life. Mr. and Mrs., I deserve 4 bedrooms and a jacuzzi, wants to buy 4 bedrooms and a jacuzzi. So they go to the mortgage broker. The mortgage broker's got 2 interests in life. Number one, he wants to process the loan so he gets his fee, and then he wants to go fishing or play golf, right, all afternoon. Right? He's got no skin in the game. He processes the loan, then he's out. He's out on the golf course. The couple who bought that house, Mr. and Mrs. 4 bedrooms and a jacuzzi, they didn't put any money down. Right? In fact, they didn't even show their income. I mean, imagine this. They didn't have to show their income to the bank. Why not? Well, it might be embarrassing to them to have to show their income or their tax form to the bank. Think about this. A couple who would willingly go on the Jerry Springer show and wrestle each other to the ground on on TV, they would be embarrassed to show their 1040. So let me tell you, I mean, this sounds hard-hearted, but the fact of the matter is there are a lot of Americans who are losing their homes today who never had any money down to begin with, all right? And look, if you look at the map of where this has taken place, 8 out of the 10 largest metropolitan areas for foreclosures are in Florida and California, all right? If you look at the map of delinquencies and foreclosures, it's California, it's Florida, it's Phoenix, and it's Las Vegas. Those of you, all of you here, who are not obviously from those areas, if I were you, I would get clubs and beat the hell out of anyone you see from Florida, California, except for me. Go on with the story. So Mr. and Mrs. 4 bedrooms and jacuzzi, they get the mortgage broker gets in there, they get the loan from the bank, sends the loan, it gets securitized to Wall Street, and then the credit agencies come into play. Right? Because they're going to grade these mortgages that are securitized and are sold by Wall Street institutions. And who works for the mortgage agency? I'm sorry, who works for the credit rating agencies? I'll tell you. Let's say it's, I'm actually going to be giving a talk later today at the university. So let's say it's recruiting day, right? The university for business school students, okay? All the kids rush over to Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley because those were always seen as the cream of the crop in investment banking. And they'll hire only the A-plus students. The next tier of students, if you can't get a job, if you couldn't get a job at Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, you'd go one tier down, really great institutions, Credit Suisse, First Boston, UBS, J.P. Morgan. If you couldn't get a job there, if you're a B-plus student, maybe you get a job at a perfectly good place, as it was at one time, Lehman Brothers. If you can't get a job at Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, you end up at Bear Stearns, that was okay. And if you couldn't get a job, if you were a C student, or D student, and you couldn't get a job at Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, Bear Stearns, J.P. Morgan, Credit Suisse, First Boston, all of the sponsors here today, where did you end up? The credit rating, the rating agencies. And what was your job there? Your job was to grade the work of the smart kids who got the good jobs, all right? And so how did that work? Well, you're looking at their papers, all these mortgage-backed securities, and you say, well, this is a C, this is a C, this is a C, this is a C. This is lousy mortgage stuff. Then you think, wait a minute, there's one thing I did learn in business school. A diversified portfolio diminishes risk. So I'll put them all together, and then I'll stamp it with an A. So these kids who never saw an A on a paper in their lives, that they finally get to have an A on a paper sitting in front of them on their desk. All right?
You're listening to a KSKA special presentation, Our Economy in the Age of Change by Todd Buchholz. Besides having been an economic advisor to the first President Bush, Buchholz is a frequent economic commentator on ABC News, PBS, CBS, and CNBC. He's also written articles for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and Forbes. We return now to Mr. Buchholz and his keynote address at the January 28th luncheon meeting of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation.
Lack of skin in the game. Irresponsibility. I want to contrast this with, this is a book I wrote, New Ideas from Dead CEOs. I'm sorry if this looks like an advertisement. You can tell if a speaker is pushing his books because when he's done, he blocks the exits with boxes of books. I didn't bring one with me. How many of you have BlackBerries and iPhones with you? Well, feel free to go to Amazon.com while I'm speaking and download it. That's okay. All right. How many of you are familiar with the name Giannini? Giannini. Okay, a few people over here. Yeah, let me tell you his story quickly. Lessons for how we should act in economically difficult times. Amedeo Giannini, born 1870, outside of San Francisco. His father runs an orchard. His parents are immigrants from Italy. The boy loves to make rounds of the orchard with his father. One day, he's 6 or 7 years old. He sees his father get in an argument with a disgruntled farm worker. The boy stands there as a witness as the farm worker draws a gun from his waistband and shoots the father on the spot. The father dies. The widow moves the family into the city of San Francisco. Now, young Amedeo Giannini is a whiz at math. He's a smart kid, but he has no interest in sitting still in the classroom. Today, they'd say he has ADD, and they give him Ritalin. By the way, this ADD thing, you ever think we give it an abbreviation because we don't have the time or the patience to spell out the whole thing? We're going to move on. ADD, okay. So what does he do? He quits school. Let me ask you, when you go to San Francisco as a tourist, shout out some of the tourist destinations. All right, Fisherman. Alcatraz. That gentleman over there said Alcatraz. Keep an eye on him. Fisherman's Wharf. The boy falls in love with Fisherman's Wharf. Excuse me. There were no jugglers in Fisherman's Wharf 120 years ago. There was no aquarium. He fell in love with commerce. He falls in love with the fruit and vegetable and the fish and the brokering business, quits school, and makes a fortune as a teenager in the fruit and vegetable market as a broker. Then he decides he wants to start a bank. He starts a little bank for working class people, because working class people couldn't get a loan back then. There's J.P. Morgan on the left. J.P. Morgan would lend to the Vanderbilts, the Rockefellers, the Goulds. If you didn't need the money, J.P. was there for you. But he wouldn't lend to working class people, so Giannini starts a little bank. He calls it the Bank of Italy. The Bank of Italy. Okay, scroll ahead a few years. Wednesday, April 18th. Excuse me again. 1906, the San Francisco earthquake strikes. The city reduced to rubble. Gas mains break. Fires everywhere. On Saturday, following that Wednesday earthquake, the leading bankers of the day gather together in a conference room and bang a gavel on the following resolution. We, the bankers of this city of San Francisco, do hereby declare that we are closed for 6 months. Yeah, 6 months. Hey, we can't touch the vaults. We got to put value on the collateral. 6 months, yeah, that'll take that long. Giannini, with his little Bank of Italy, steps forward and says, you're closed 6 months? I'm opening tomorrow, Sunday for a Catholic in San Francisco in 1906. Well, how does he do that? Well, they save some money in a sack. They roll two wooden barrels out to a wharf, slap a wooden plank across the top, and begin doling out credit. You seen the movie It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart? Based on Amedeo Giannini and the courage he showed during the earthquake and bank runs of the Great Depression. What difference does courage and leadership make in economically, politically, socially difficult times? If you Google image San Francisco, 1907, 1 year after the earthquake, and see how it was rebuilt with greater opulence than ever before, and compare that sadly to New Orleans today, 2.5 years after Hurricane Katrina, you'll see the difference courage and leadership make. Now, I'm not here to give you motivational, inspirational. I don't want you all to end up hugging each other, but that's okay. I'm supposed to be talking about the economy. He gives us lessons on how to act economically during challenging times. one of his lessons as a financial institution was this: never lend any money to anyone unless you know more about their business than they do themselves. All right? So, for instance, he lends money to the Borden milk farmers when nobody else would, because he learns about the dairy farms and realizes next year's milk is a form of collateral. In 1940, when Walt Disney, see that over there, lower left, in 1940, when Walt Disney wants to do Snow White, actually, I didn't mean he wanted to do Snow White. I mean, maybe he did, but I don't know. No one would lend him the money. But it was Giannini who realized that the film negative, the celluloid, was a form of collateral, right? What does that have to do with us today? The housing meltdown in so many parts of the U.S., and actually more than just the U.S. now. I was in Arizona speaking to FDIC officials. It turns out in 2005, the bankers in Arizona thought that 200,000 people had moved into the state. The reality, it turned out, was merely 85,000 had moved into the state. How is it they thought 200 and it turned out to be 85? Well, first of all, they didn't have someone with such precise forecasts as our friend Bill. But secondly, they didn't understand the construction industry and the housing sector. They didn't realize, it never occurred to them, those homes were being built on spec. Right? And they saw houses being erected and they figured people are moving in. It turned out not to be the case. You got to know more than your counterparty about his or her own business. And this obviously goes beyond banking. You know, it doesn't matter which part of the Anchorage economy you're in. You need, especially if you're providing a service, professional service, technical service, you better know more than the person you're trying to sell your services to. All right. So Giannini teaches us that lesson and many other lessons. And by the way, that little Bank of Italy today is known as the Bank of America, right? Which, you know, granted is struggling at the moment, but boy, what an institution he turned it into from the waterfront in San Francisco. And I mentioned John Thane, the Merrill CEO, who spent over $1 million on his office. A.P. Giannini, the founder and CEO of the Bank of America, said, "I will never become a millionaire." And you know what? Late in his career, as the bank took off, his accountant went to him and said, "You know, AP, you're becoming perilously close to breaking your pledge. The value of your holdings are pretty darn close to a million." He took out a checkbook and wrote a check to charity for $500,000. So when he died, he was no millionaire. Compare that to a CEO today who would spend that on redecorating his office in the midst of an economic recession. All right. No excuses for bad service either. I have to tell you, I was with my wife in New York, and I was going to the theater, and I only had a few minutes to grab something to eat, so I went into a Pizza Hut, and I got to the front of the line. Young woman looks at me, big doe eyes apologetically, and says, "I'm sorry, we're out of pizza." Like, well, so what are you now, hut? Customer focus. By the way, obviously the travel and tourism industry is very near and dear to Alaska. In fact, I have to tell you, this is my third time in the state. My first two times were as a passenger on cruise ships. And I had an interesting experience that I wanted to pass on because, something like 8% or so of the Alaskan economy is tourism-derived, and Anchorage is a large share, as, again, the presentation pointed out earlier. I was going skiing with my family a week ago, and a few days before we left, I received a phone call from the concierge at the hotel that we were going to be staying at. And he said, "You know, we're very crowded this weekend." It was actually Martin Luther King weekend. It was a holiday weekend. He said, "You know, I don't want you to have to stand in line. If there's anything I can help you with now, restaurant reservations, ski lesson reservations, and so on, I'd be delighted to do it." I did not take this as an incursion, invasion of my privacy. I was quite happy. It was fine. And then it turned out what he was really doing was trying to line us up to take a tour of the timeshares, right? Which I didn't resent either. That was his job. But it struck me as, in a time where we are concerned in Anchorage about tourism dollars dropping a little bit or sagging a little bit, now is the time to become a little more aggressive and a little more innovative. If you know you've got people coming here, then why not see what incidentals you can sell to them, not because you're exploiting them, what opportunities you can show them in advance so it's not a last-minute kind of sale. So I just want to point that on, and you can attribute that to the Marriott in Lake Tahoe taught me that lesson. All right, I'm going to spin ahead a couple slides. One reason why the economy, the national economy, has become more and more difficult to forecast is because the nature of what we produce has changed in this economy. That Arm & Hammer logo, to me, represents how the value of our economy used to be based just on weight, on mass, on muscle. Now the value of our economy increasingly comes from the human mind and technology at work. I mean, for instance, it used to be that oil and gas and mining was fairly crude in terms of the capital that's used. Now, in order to extract fossil fuels, whether from the North Slope or Exxon's got an oil rig off Siberia that drills down 2 miles and horizontally 7 miles, there's a whole lot of learning that takes place, a whole lot of technology, right? The value of our economy increasingly is coming from this professional technological focus, right? In fact, the value of entertainment in our economy, in fact, is significant these days. Raise your hand if you're a fan of Star Wars, the Star Wars movie. Okay. This gentleman here, what's your name, sir?
Darren.
What's this who's this character on the left?
Yoda.
Yoda. First we do the eyesight test. Now the real test for Darren. When George Lucas releases a new Star Wars movie, a real fan of Star Wars will drag a lawn chair, a cot, a sleeping bag across town and sleep in front of the local theater because he's got to be there on opening night. Darren, did you do that? You're out of the sketch. I'm sorry. All right. All right. I was giving a briefing to President Bush. I should point out, I was an economic advisor to President Bush the First, George Herbert Walker Bush. For the Sun, I consulted now and then. Although clearly he didn't listen to a word I said, but, you know, you try. So around the time that Lucas had released his latest Star Wars movie, I'd given a briefing to George W. Bush, and I brought with me a DVD disc. I said, Mr. President, this has a movie on it. If this is the new Star Wars movie, which has not yet been released, we could auction off this disc for millions and millions of dollars. So great is the hunger, the thirst for his movies, that fans throughout the world, real fans, not like Darren, but real fans will sleep in the streets. And yet, Mr. President, it weighs nothing. Is it the weight that gives it the value? No. Is it, I don't know, silver oxide or some precious chemical component? No. It's the ideas inherent in it and the imagination that makes this worth millions. I went on for a while. Finally, Bush interrupted me. He said, Todd, all right, I understand the light economy. I understand the Berlin Wall, but is that really the Star Wars movie? It was my daughter's Rugrats movie. He paid $300,000 for it. I thought that was a pretty good price. All right. Increasingly, the value comes from the human mind. I mean, think about it in the transportation sector. You know, the logistical sector is so important to Anchorage and to Alaska. That movie with Marlon Brando, he played a surly character named Terry Malloy. I won't get into it, but in that era, in the 1950s, when a ship came into port, it took 100 men a week to unload a vessel in port. 100 men a week. Now in a modern port, 7 guys can do it in one day. And if they hired women, they'd knock it off in half a day, because women ask for directions. But, right. Men play bumper cars with the forklifts and all of that, right? This has been a revolution in transportation, a technological revolution in transportation that has stomped on distribution costs, creating a more competitive global economy. This is why we, Anchorage, Alaska, the United States of America, we are in a race. Forget about NASDAQ and Dow points. We are in a race for IQ points.
You're listening to Todd Buchholz and his keynote address at the recent Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's annual forecast luncheon. Besides his work as a White House advisor, broadcast commentator, and author of several books and magazine articles, Buchholz is an award-winning teacher at Harvard University. We return now to KSKA's special presentation, Our Economy in the Age of Change.
Again, Bill's presentation pointed out one of the biggest obstacles to growth here in Anchorage is finding skilled professional and technical workers. We're in a race for IQ points. Whatever town, city, country harnesses intelligence will prosper most in the 21st century. These are job creation and destruction numbers during the 90s jobs boom. We created 20 million net new jobs, but we lost jobs. Stevedores, timber, farmers, sewers, typesetters, gain jobs, engineers, science, architects, legal assistants, financial services. This is why the most important long-term economic issue is not what Ben Bernanke does today. It's not what the Congress does with Barack Obama's stimulus package. The most important long-term economic issue is what we do about our education system, which is faltering in so many parts of the United States. Our young people, think about the Beijing Olympics. Our young people did brilliantly at the Beijing Olympics. When you look at math, science, Olympiads, our high school kids, we had the Jamaican bobsled team of education. True. And this is our most important, this has got to be one of our most important focuses or foci, as my English teacher might have told me to say, right? Education. All right. The economic turmoil that we're in, how did we get into it? Well, last time we fell into an economic recession, I wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal. We could beat our foes. Federal Reserve Board. Back in 2000, 2001, the Fed jacked up interest rates to 6.5%. Why? They were afraid of inflation. They were wrong. There was no inflation. And they didn't know about that. They didn't understand it because they didn't understand the Berlin Wall. That's why I had to go through this thematic stuff first. They didn't realize the middle class would begin to feel this squeeze from the Berlin Wall and India and China opening. The price of oil had gone up in 2000, 2001, and then, of course, the euro was introduced and promptly lost a third of its value. So American exporters from McDonald's to Dell couldn't make any money. Where do we stand today? The Federal Reserve Board has rewritten everything. It used to be, we'll only lend to banks. Now we'll lend to banks, we'll lend to insurance companies, we'll lend to the caterer, you know, we'll lend to anybody. It used to be they would only buy treasury notes. Now, my God, if you show the monopoly money to Ben Bernanke, he'd look at it and say, well, Art Linker letter? Sure, we'll accept that, right? They'll take anything. And you know what? It's been the right thing to do. The Fed was slow-footed and slow-minded for about a year, and they finally caught up to reality during the fall, and they are right to slam interest rates down and get the money supply pumping. That is necessary. Oil. Now, oil and gas prices and commodity prices are a very important topic here, of course. And in some ways, it's sort of counter-cyclical with the rest of the country, because Alaska clearly benefits higher oil prices. Most of the country doesn't. We had a bubble. And there's so many so-called experts who thought it wasn't a bubble. That was a bubble that we saw, $147 a barrel. It wasn't just energy. It was cocoa. It was soybeans. It was corn. It was a commodity bubble everywhere. People were writing about peak oil. I don't believe in peak oil. That's a lot of baloney. I believe in peak people. It's not peak oil, it's peak people. You want to extract more fossil fuels? The U.S. better produce more petroleum engineers than it did 20 years ago. The number has fallen by 90%. You worry about commodities and food. We need to produce more food for the world. Well, we need more agricultural scientists than we did 20 years ago, and that number hasn't gone up. If Alaska and its university system wants to do something forward-looking and innovative, both for itself and for the world, university departments focusing on mining, materials, commodities, really fell into, I wouldn't say fell into disuse, but they weren't sexy places to be. Because starting in 1980, commodity prices just rolled downward. There, as far as I know, is no university in the world that can claim to be, you know, the MIT of commodities. And yet commodities, feeding the world, fueling the world, is one of the most important challenges for the 21st century. So I would say that the education system in Alaska is well placed to become, for lack of a better term, the MIT, or the, as Johns Hopkins is to medicine. Why shouldn't the University of Alaska be to commodities? That is out there for you, and it's also a benefit to the rest of the world. Okay. There are some, here's my view on the economy. The economy is miserable right now in the U.S. The economy is bad. It is decaying almost across the board. However, I do not believe we're going to have the Great Depression too, and I do not believe the economy is going to be as severely hit as it was in 1981, 1982, when unemployment went up to nearly 11%. Here's some signposts. I want to give you some signposts to look at and some reasons to feel not great about the economy because it's lousy, but to feel as if we're going to survive in 2009, and by the end of the year, we'll probably have some positive growth. First of all, here's what took place in the economy. You had this credit crisis. In September and October, every banker in the world slammed down the gates. No lending. That was it. Slammed down the gates. It didn't matter. You could be in Vladivostok, Vancouver, Anchorage, or sunny South Beach, Florida. They slammed down the gates. Right? The spreads widened up, meaning if U.S. Treasuries were yielding 3% and you wanted to borrow or issue a bond, you'd be paying 10%. Those spreads widened. And basically, there was no lending going on. It froze the economy. I don't think we're going back to the 1970s. Just to remind you of the 70s, stagflation. Those of you who remember the 70s, read about the stagflation. Just to remind you, upper left, there's Jimmy Carter. Lower left, there's his singing group, the Village People. We're not going to have stagflation. Why aren't we going to have stagflation? Because we're not going to have the inflation. Because if you look in the dictionary under stagflation, always followed by the term wage price spiral. There ain't no wage price spiral in the United States of America. Why? Because of the Berlin Wall and because of the chopsticks. Right? Inflation, in fact, is dead. At least for the next couple of years, inflation is dead. I'm not going to dwell too much on this. The consumer in America is obviously pulled back. I'm delighted that Anchorage is still able to attract Best Buy and Kohl's and Walgreens and Target opening up. The rest of America is really having trouble in the consumer sector. We are changing where we're spending money. Look at these lines here. Warren Buffett had said, you never know who's swimming naked till the tide goes out. All right? Well, the tide has gone out, and we found out a lot of people were skinny dipping. And it's an ugly sight now to see who is skinny dipping. These lines here, the upper line, that's Walmart. Walmart's been doing fine. The one that's fallen off a cliff, that's Saks Fifth Avenue. Saks Fifth Avenue fell into Second Avenue. First, it's dumping into the East River. Why? You know why. You've got friends as I do, so-called affluent friends, who were strutting around the last couple years and got the Rolex here, got the Baume & Mercier watch here, got the lease on the Jaguar, got the biggest Escalade I could buy, and the time. Those people now, those affluent friends, are now standing in line at Walmart for the 10-pack of underwear. Yeah. And they'd rather be at Costco, but they can't afford the membership card anymore. All right? We obviously are reallocating where we're spending money. I'm skipping a couple slides. Housing. Housing, as you know, here in Alaska, in Anchorage, there's not going to be much new construction. I mean, that's frozen because people here are concerned about the rest of the world, rest of the country. The only hopeful sign we now see on housing is that no new construction is taking place. That means no new inventory. In fact, this week it was announced that the inventories have fallen from about 11-month supply to a 9.5-month supply. All right? So there's nothing positive about housing except that it's probably about 3/4 of the way done in terms of prices falling. And I think by the end of the summer, I'm looking for an economic recovery around the same time, if we're lucky, for back-to-school sales. All right? I'm looking for the consumer to emerge in time for back-to-school spending, which is a good indicator for Christmas spending. And for the next 3 to 4 or 5 months, I think it's looking pretty dark. It is looking, I can't deny that. All right. Some signposts to keep an eye on. The job market. The job market has been deteriorating. I mean, thankfully here in Anchorage, you may be steady, flat is good. The job market has been deteriorating, but the headlines have been wrong and distorted. You are seeing headlines saying more layoffs since 1981 or 1982. You're seeing more unemployment filings, jobless claims, since 81, 82. These morons who run these financial newspapers don't realize that the job market is twice the size as it was in the early 80s. So when they say, as they did last Thursday, 580,000 people applied for jobless unemployment claims, the same as was in 1981, they should be telling you 580,000 filed today, right? In 81, it would be it should be compared to 1 million. Right? So the job market, while bad, is not as bloody as the headlines are suggesting to us. Okay, we now have, well, how are we going to get out of this recovery? We got the lowest rates since Shakespeare. The Bank of England has lowered rates, the lowest rates since William Shakespeare. Unfortunately, the European Central Bank has been constipated. Right? Bank of England's got the lowest rates since Shakespeare. The European Central Bank's got the lowest rates since 2005. Imagine, they think the economy today is akin to 2005. It's more like 1905 than 2005, but eventually the European Bank is catching up. Interest rates are coming down. The Great Depression hoax. It's not the Great Depression. It's not even the 1980s. I don't want to dwell on too many slides here. How are we going to get out of this? Interest rates are falling. Mortgage rates are falling. Prices are falling. That actually means that those Americans who keep their jobs, which will be probably 90% will keep their jobs, have more buying power. That's what's going to get us out of this. The increase in buying power, the fall in oil, while it may mean a little bit of a crunch in Alaska in some ways, has injected an extra $300 a month into pocketbooks of families. This is a chart that shows real weekly earnings have actually been popping up. Those of you reading about economics, you know the name John Maynard Keynes. He was the British economist during the Depression who said, if you're in a recession or depression, have the government spend money anywhere. He disagreed with his teacher, who was a guy named Arthur Cecil Pigou. And Arthur Cecil Pigou essentially said, as long as the government prints money, and if you've got the prices falling, real buying power can get you out of a recession. We're going to see a test of this right now, a better test than the stimulus in Washington. This stimulus thing, it's going to be $1 trillion, and most of it, to me, is going to be nonsense. Mailing checks to one another, right? Mailing checks to one another because that'll make us feel better when the mailman arrives. Paving over with blacktop, you know, every last inch of the country you can find. I don't believe in that. I'd rather have, what we need to do in this country is to give people incentives to do new stuff, not to make up for past blunders. We should be cutting taxes for any company that hires a new employee. We ought to cut taxes to any laid-off worker who takes another job, even if it's at a lower wage. We ought to be giving a tax cut to any company that buys a new piece of equipment, any company that invests another dollar in R&D than they did last year. That's what we ought to be incentivizing, as opposed to spending a whole lot of money, paying off special interests. You cannot, if you have a corporate jet, I don't, maybe you do, you can't get a landing slot in Washington, D.C. this week. Oh, you can't get in there. You can't get a cab because the lobbyists have descended. The asphalt industry is competing against the cement industry. Here, quite seriously, this was in the Wall Street Journal today. The asphalt industry wants more money for road repairs. The cement industry said, no, don't give them that. We want new roads because that's all done with new cement. Anyway, I don't believe it's the stimulus that's going to get us out. I actually think it's monetary policy that's going to get us out. I know we're tight with time, a couple minutes left, and we'll have time for a couple of questions. What about psychology? Is it possible merely by electing President Obama could help the economy? It is possible. Psychologists did an experiment back in the Great Depression and came up with something called the Hawthorne effect. There was a factory, a Western Electric factory, and they took the workers and they experimented. They said, let's give them a few more breaks during the day, a few less breaks, a little bonus here, a little pocket money, and they discovered that change is good. Almost any change, shaking things up, actually helped. Now, I did some research recently. I discovered that, for instance, firing a hockey coach in the middle of the season tends to help a little bit. Firing a basketball coach in the middle of the season tends to help a little bit. Firing a soccer coach hurts a little bit. Well, as far as I'm concerned, Americans don't really care much about soccer past the grade school level. So I'm going with the basketball and hockey examples, and I hope that shaking things up in Washington leads to some boost in confidence. Last Maverick standing. Hey, Barack Obama won because he was the last Maverick. He did a better job of explaining that he was not part of old Washington. John McCain was the Maverick, but, you know, John McCain had been in Washington 20 years. Hillary Clinton said, I'm different, but, of course, she'd been in the White House for 8 years, right? And then in the Senate. So Barack Obama took it all. I don't have to recall the bruising campaign, except to tell you this, a friend of mine called me up towards the end, and he said, John McCain needs to make a whole lot more out of Sarah Palin's hunting skills. I said, why? He's a money manager, this friend of mine. He said, because if the economy gets any worse, hunting and gathering is all we're going to have left here. So reindeer jerky, you know, for one on each plate. Okay, let's turn off the slides here, and let me close this way. I believe there's going to be an economic recovery. I don't think we're going to be seeing it soon. I think the stock market, you know, has looked good the last couple of days. The Dow is now up to about 8,400. Can it get past 9,000? So far, it's tried and failed badly when it's tried. If it breaks out, that might be good. But I'm not looking for a quick turnaround in the economy in the next couple of months or 3 or 6 months. I do think that these economic stimulative forces are going to finally take hold in the fall, maybe just in time for the fall. But make no mistake, these are treacherous economic and financial times we are living in. I want to quote one last movie. There was a movie called The Third Man with Orson Welles. It took place in Vienna after World War II. Nobody knew what would happen to Austria after World War II, a time of chaos and intrigue. The Orson Welles character says, in Italy, under the Borgias, there was warfare, murder, bloodshed, terror. But they produced Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci and the Renaissance. He says, Switzerland, 500 years of peace and quiet, and what did they come up with? The cuckoo clock, right? My point is, in this maelstrom, in this perfect storm, made from ice storms across America at the moment, made of fears of hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, worries about global warming, right? Bitter political infighting, financial market meltdowns, the looming fears of terrorism throughout the world. This now is still the opportunity for prosperity. This now is still our opportunity for innovation. This now is our opportunity to make a better life for our children, for our neighbors, for our family, for our community, and for our country. So I thank the AEDC so much for inviting me here this afternoon, and thank you for being such a great audience. Good luck to all of you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Harvard economics teacher and author Todd Buchholz. Mr. Buchholz spoke at the annual forecast luncheon held by the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation on January 28th. His topic was Our Economy in an Age of Change. You can learn more about Todd Buchholz, his articles and books, as well as the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation by going to our website, ksKA.org. For KSKA, this is Len Anderson, thanking you for listening.